asked me was, what was in room IOI? I told you that you knew the answer already. Everyone knows it. The thing that is in room IOI is... information on intelligence.
Hello and good evening, everyone. This is Hackerspace's Signal, and we're welcoming you to this February the 3rd show of Room IOI. Tonight's focus will be on Egypt, January 25th, and everything kind of surrounding this topic. And as a first guest tonight, I would like to welcome Kyra, aka Karen Kozina. Hi, Kyra.
Hello.
So, not everyone on this channel might be familiar with your name. Would you like to introduce yourself? What are you working on? What's your particular focus? What are you interested in?
Okay. Hi, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks, Esther, for inviting me. I'm a hacker. I'm part of the MetaLab hackerspace in Vienna. I'm originally a C++ OpenGL person. But I'm also interested in a bunch of other things outside of pure technology. I've been an activist for freedom in the digital age for many, many years. I'm a former board member of the Free Software Foundation Europe. I'm also on the jury of the Austrian Big Brother Awards. And I recently started studying at the Vienna Diplomatic Academy, where I'm going to do a 2-year master program on international studies. So obviously this situation is of very great interest to me because it combines these two things, my interest in international relations and politics on the one hand, and then on the other hand, technology and how it can be used as a way to create a more free and fair and democratic world, or how it can be abused at the same time.
Yeah, I think today's topic really talks a lot about abuse of these things. Probably not everyone who's listening in right now is up to date with the topic or with what happened since, let's say, probably January the 22nd or January the 23rd. I think that was the date when I first saw these hashtags popping up on Twitter on a very regular basis. But now it's like a couple of hundred updates each day that I see scrolling by. And, well, Kyra, could you explain to us what happened within, like, the last week or the last 2 weeks, just briefly?
Absolutely, Esther. I think that maybe 50 of those 100 updates are probably from me, anyway, on your screen. But I'd like to actually go a few more days back, because what's happening at the moment really goes back to January 14th. When the revolution happened in Tunisia, on January 14th, the former president Ben Ali was ousted. He fled the country and a new provisional government took power. And that was the great victory of the Tunisian people, a victory against the corrupt regime that they did not consider legitimate anymore. And that was a historic moment, something that we hadn't seen before ever happening in the Arab world, that the people stand up and kick out their dictator. And it was this uprising in Tunisia that really inspired a lot of other people. And that's also what you'll hear the Egyptians say, you know, that Tunisians could do it, we can do it as well. And so people started thinking, you know, what can we do? Are we happy? I mean, people obviously weren't happy. And the plan came together of staging protests in Egypt to voice the dissatisfaction with the current ruler, which is, of course, President Hosni Mubarak. And these protests were planned for January 25th. January 25th, and that's the hashtag that you all have been seeing, of course, Jan 25. That was actually a national holiday in Egypt. It's, ironically enough, a day to commemorate the police forces, who are one of the main targets of this outrage of the people. So the Egyptian people decided to have a protest on that day, January 25th, to say all is not well. Basically, you know, Mubarak, we want you to step down. So that's when it all started. That was Tuesday. And when it became clear that there would be no real reaction on behalf of the government and on behalf of the president, protests continued. You know, people didn't go home. It was already quite interesting that so many people showed up for those protests on January 25. But people continued to show up and protest on January 26 and 27. And the plan was made that on January 28th, there'd be another huge day of protests. That was going to be Friday. And after Friday prayers, people would all go to Tahrir Square in Cairo and other places in major cities and hold another demonstration. And of course, it was in the night from Thursday to Friday that the Egyptian government decided to shut down the internet. So since then, what's been going on? There have been protests ever since then. Unfortunately, the situation escalated a bit. There was some violence in the streets. There was some looting being done. A lot of people say it wasn't actually the protesters that did that. But it's hard to say, of course, from the distance. Probably a few of you have seen President Mubarak's speech that he gave in basically around midnight, Tuesday to Wednesday, where he said once again, no, I'm not going to step down. I'm not going to run for the next presidential elections, but I'm not going to step down, which was his way of a gesture of saying, look, isn't this enough? And the clear reaction of the people in the street was, no, it's not enough. People were shouting, Mubarak, leave, leave. It's unprecedented scenes. It's amazing to watch this for so many, many years. I mean, Mubarak has been in power for 30 years. For so many years, the Egyptian people have been living in fear. Nobody dared to even criticize Mubarak in public, if we're honest. And now you have all these people out in the street saying, enough, kifaya. This cannot continue.
Now, as you mentioned, the uprisings in Tunisia, I think we've all heard or seen people tweet or write about it, blog about it, and mention it as a Twitter revolution, as in a revolution that's been made possible because people used mainly Twitter, but a lot of Web 2.0 tools. Now, this is something that I think we cannot say about the protests in Egypt. However, Twitter has been basically as a tool of organization. What do we know about the internet outage that happened in Egypt? I mean, we've seen countries filtering really heavily particular websites, particular IP blocks. Now, we're not talking about filtering anymore when we look at Egypt. What's happening there?
Okay, allow me to go back for just a moment, because you said, you know, Tunisia being the Twitter revolution. And that's in itself a complicated issue, because, of course, it wasn't a Twitter revolution. It was a revolution of people in the street. And we may not forget that. I mean, people died for the freedom of the Tunisian people. However, you are right in that in Tunisia, Web 2.0 and social networks played a much, much larger role. And it is, in fact, I personally believe that without that, without the internet, without these tools for people to coordinate, the Tunisian revolution would not have been possible. And I talked to people in Tunisia and asked them, you know, because there is this debate going on in the West, to what degree are these tools valuable? Was it a Twitter revolution? Was it not? And I wanted to ask people who were there. And I got this wonderful quote from a Tunisian person who was involved in the revolution. And he said, no, you know, without the internet, this massacre would have happened in silence. Nobody would have known about it. 5 years ago, before Facebook, before Twitter, the same uprising would have been smothered immediately. So that was really interesting for me to hear. As you say, Egypt is a very, very different situation. But what's interesting about Egypt is that it's not only because they shut down the internet that Twitter and Facebook weren't that important, because the Egyptian people were very much aware that Facebook and Twitter would not be a very good platform for organizing a revolution. Twitter and Facebook are very good for getting information out, for, you know, making sure that people see the photos, see the videos, hear the testimony of people on the ground. They are a horrible platform for arranging schedules, figuring out where you want to go, and so on and so forth. Actually, on the first day, even on January 25th, Tuesday, that was way before the internet was blocked, they had published marching routes on Facebook that were intentionally false, because people organizing the protests knew that the secret police was actually watching the accounts of people that were known to be involved with the opposition. And the real organization already happened on other channels, which is also why when they finally cut down the internet, it didn't really hit people so hard, because people in Egypt, the actual protesters, didn't expect to have internet connectivity. They didn't need Twitter or Facebook to organize where they would go and what they would do and so on and so forth. In fact, the shutting down of mobile phone network that happened, for instance, on January 26, I think, was a much more problematic thing for people on the ground.
So you were mentioning also the coverage of this topic and of the protests. And I think one very interesting fact is that all of the Western media, and I'm looking especially at the States right now, did not even dare to mention anything about it. Like, not only that they wouldn't, you know, show that they had a specific position, a specific, reasoning about what's happening, or a specific interest in getting out false information, but they didn't really cover it at all. This is very different to one station, which is Al Jazeera, who has also been asked to, you know, not cover the subject anymore. What do you think about... We can clearly see why a country that, or why, you know, a president that would not want this uprising of the people to become too public and to be much more of a hassle to him and his position, because he has to, in some of the other way, justify his position to the outside world. But shutting down the internet is something that actually makes people in this country rage even more and you know, become more polemic about the topic, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's actually 2 points you brought up, and I think both of them are very important. So if you don't mind, I'd like to go back to what you said before about the media. The traditional classical media, say, you know, television as a great example. It's funny, you know, the Western media didn't pick up on the whole thing for a long, long time. And Al Jazeera, to be fair, in the start didn't pick up on it either. You know, it took them some time. I think they really started covering it maybe around last Friday. But at least they started doing it. The Western media, well, the reason why they're not covering it is quite simple, because the official position of the United States and the official position of Europe is that Egypt is a factor of stability in the region, and everybody is super scared that, you know, things will become less stable. Egypt is the one country that has quote-unquote peaceful relations with Israel, and this is also the reason why, Barack Obama didn't speak up in defense of the Egyptian people, and he didn't say, you know, it's not okay that the protests are violently being stopped and that the media are being blocked and that all your communications are being shut down. He did speak out on behalf of the Iranian people when their protests in June, July 2009 had faced a similar opposition. Why was that? It's quite clear, because, you know, he doesn't want to lose the opportunity of being on the right side no matter what happens. So if these protests don't lead to anything, we can say, look, we always supported you President Mubarak. If the protesters get their demands and there is a new government, then again, the West could say, look, we always knew you were going to do it and we just didn't want to interfere. Then it's the same thing with the European Union. I mean, I don't want to be harping on the United States because we are no better. There is this beautiful declaration by the Austrian High Representative for Foreign Affairs, Catherine Ashton, that basically had absolutely no content. You know, it was like, oh yeah, let's just be nice to one another and can't we just like not have any violence and please let's have stability, but of course you have legitimate demands. So everybody doesn't, you know, tries to avoid having to take sides. And the media, we're very much doing the same thing. Let's just not bring this up because nobody wants a revolution in Egypt, in the West. Nobody cared about Tunisia. You know, Tunisia, it's kind of cute, well, like our holiday country, and suddenly they have a revolution. That's kind of nice. Egypt? Oh, my God, you know? So, and it was interesting that Al-Shazira was really the only one showing the protests the way they were. On Egyptian state TV, you saw empty streets. On Al-Shazira, you saw, you know, tens of thousands of people in Tahrir Square. And the Egyptian government actually shut down the offices of Al-Shazira a day ago. They briefly arrested six journalists of Al-Shazira and basically said, you know, you're not allowed to broadcast anymore. Al-Jazeera is still broadcasting. They surprised a lot of people by how they were covering these protests. And I'm not saying they don't have an agenda, because they do, and it's quite clear. But then again, every news outlet does. But the fact that they are showing the raw material is quite amazing, especially because the internet is shut down. If we had internet connection to Egypt, the internet would be flooded with YouTube videos and photographs and so on and so forth. At the moment, there is this tiny trickle of things getting through by, you know, all kinds of workarounds, but it's just very, very hard to get information out. And that's a very, very interesting thing, I thought. Then now you get a lot of tweets, if you look at Twitter, that have images attached that are screen grabs of Al-Shazira's live stream. So you have the traditional media, a TV station reporting, putting their report on the internet, and then Twitter and Facebook on and so on and so forth, picking that up and spreading it through our communication channels. Whereas, for instance, back in Iran, in the protests after the elections in June 2009, you had the opposite thing, that people uploaded videos to YouTube and then the traditional media started taking these YouTube videos and showed them on television. So in a way, the situation is reversed. And in the absence of internet connectivity, that traditional media again stepped in and took over doing this coverage.
Now let me ask a really, really super naive question. What is the point in getting the information about the protests and about the uprising of the people out of the country in order to gather support from, let's say, just Twitter readers or the ordinary people if no other state wants to get involved?
Well, the whole point is that states will have to get involved if their people demand it. And that's the whole idea of building political pressure. And that's why it's so important that this information does get out. Because if you have a country and you can impose a total news blackout and nobody knows what's going on there, who cares if a bunch of thousand people are shot, you know? But of course, if people see this, they'll say, wait a second, this is not okay. And I'm certainly not calling for any kind of military intervention, don't get me wrong. But, you know, we are giving so much money to Egypt. We are giving so much money to the Egyptian government. We are doing business with these people. And, you know, if you're upset, this is not okay, the way you're handling this is not okay. If we saw Mubarak ordering the army to fire on the protesters and they complied, which they probably wouldn't, but say they did, and we saw that, do you think anybody in Europe would say, oh, but you know what, let's continue doing business with those guys, because it's, who cares?
I'm wondering, on a very personal note, if you're reading through these posts, seeing these videos, seeing this information, what is your personal reaction? And what is it that you think people should be doing that are outside of Egypt at the moment?
It's a tough question because there aren't really that many things you can do. Look, one of the things that I'm trying to explain to people is the situation is more complicated than it seems at first sight. And I realize that probably a bunch of the people listening in right now will not be very happy to hear that. But at the end of the day, you know, there's very little that we can do. I mean, yeah, it's fantastic if we sign petition to, you know, call on Egypt to stop blocking the internet. But frankly, is it going to make much of a difference? No. And a lot of the things that are going on are more complex than they appear at first sight. And that's the one thing that I'm trying to tell people, and that's maybe something I'd like to say to all of you who are listening to this right now. Please, let's be more careful how we deal with the data that we get. Keep in mind, this is all raw data, and you have to do the analysis yourself. These are just individual points, and you have to connect them into a bigger picture. And very often, there are several pictures you can connect the dots into. And just because one is obvious doesn't mean it's the correct one. One thing that I find troublesome about the crowdsourcing, the way we are doing it with the social media, is that people just retweet things. You know, somebody says something and it's spectacular and everybody goes, oh yeah. So like sometime last week, somebody, I'm not going to name names, but somebody got the rumor from somewhere that Mubarak had left the country and blogged about this. And everybody picked it up. It was like, Mubarak has left the country. Mubarak has left the country. It was all over the internet. He hadn't left the country. And it was impossible, you know, to go against those rumors because so many people were spreading it that everybody who saw it thought so many people can't be wrong. Now, you can't do truth determination by majority vote. That's just not how it works. That means if you have access to a piece of information that's not widespread, you have to be extra careful to verify your sources and, you know, see, does this actually make sense? Can I correlate this? Do I have confirmation? And, you know, rather wait an hour or so until you have confirmation before you post something rather than spreading false information.
I think this is a very, very important point that you just make. What I've also seen is that, you know, not only just information that might have just been a rumor being retweeted and retweeted again, but also being retweeted at like hours later, or maybe a day later, yeah, when the situation might have already changed dramatically.
Yeah, absolutely.
So going back to the whole internet outage, shutting down the announcement of the routes thing, do you personally think or have an opinion on how this could help Mubarak in the end, or might have even more so destabilized his position?
Excellent question. You know, I've been asking myself over the last days, what does the man think? Why is he acting the way he's acting? Why did he do this? And I believe the reason why he did it to begin with was because he thought he could stop people from organizing themselves. I believe that he or his advisors fell into that wrongful belief that the internet is going to be where the revolution is organized. So if I can shut down the internet, people will not be able to organize, so they'll not have protests. That, of course, didn't work out at all. Of course, I'm guessing now, right? What's really going to happen, the only thing that's absolutely affected is business. I mean, the Egyptian stock market has been down. Well, fair enough, it's probably been a good idea that it was down because it would have even fallen even more. It has already fallen like a stone. But, you know, at the end of the day, normal businesses, all the businesses in the country depend on the internet. Not all of them, obviously not the bakery around the corner, but a lot of businesses that have not been able to do business over the last week. That is going to massively damage the economy. And even more importantly, of course, it was seen as an act of complete desperation. You know, he's losing it. He's losing control. He's losing the grip on the country, and he's just taking absolutely desperate measures that are unprecedented and uncalled for. And, you know, it didn't, I mean, of course people are freaked out. And those people that were not part of the protest movement to begin with were starting to wonder, wait a second, what's going on here? And that's a very interesting point that I haven't really seen picked up in the media. You know, because the protest movement, originally it wasn't millions of people. It was mostly the unemployed. It wasn't poor people from the countryside, nor was it the middle class. It was people, say, between 16 and 35, our generation. People that had a good education, a lot of them had a university degree. They just couldn't get a job because, you know, the economy wasn't going as well as it should have. And these people said, you know, we understand that things are difficult, but we want to see real reforms. We want to see a move forward. And not only economically, but also in terms of political liberties. You know, we want to have the possibility of having real political parties, for Christ's sake. And these people were the ones starting, but wouldn't even be sure how many people would stand behind them. You know, if you go back to January 25, how many people of the well-established middle class, for instance, would have joined the protest movement? Honestly, I don't know. I'm not an expert on the Middle East. But once President Mubarak took such drastic measures, everybody got a wake-up call. Everybody was like, whoa, if he can do that, that's not good. And if he's willing to that, you know, this was, everybody suddenly realized we are not living in a democracy. We are not living, I mean, this is not the will of the people. This is somebody acting under emergency rule, which is, by the way, exactly what Egypt has been under for many, many years. But it's probably not something that people want anymore. And I think a lot of people at that point in time realized, wait a second, these people out there in the streets that say we want changes, they have a point.
So for our listeners, just a quick info. We'll go deeper into the technical aspects of this internet outage later in our second interview part. I have two more questions for you, Kyra, though. So one is, could you briefly tell us how people organize inside the country right now?
Mostly good old sneaker net. You know, people talking to one another. On, for instance, on January 27, the evening before the major protests on Friday, there was a brochure being distributed. You've probably seen it. If you haven't seen it, I can give you a link. It's an amazing historic document. Basically, you know, telling people this is where we're going to meet. This is where we want to march. This is how you should prepare. Please be peaceful. Don't do anything stupid. Don't use violence. Here's how you handle tear gas and things like that. And these things were distributed by people handing them out to people that they knew were sympathetic to the cause. Frankly, the same way, you know, people have been organizing themselves for literally hundreds of years. And shop owners would, you know, put them into the shop and give them to customers and, you know, hide them when people came in that weren't known as their customers or on the protesters' side. And I mean, there has been some phone connectivity. It's been off and on, and I can't really say when exactly it was. Today, at least in Cairo, or yesterday, mobile phone coverage at and around Tahrir Square was off. Because obviously government knows that people will call one another. It's obvious, right? You say, don't go over there. There's massive police presence there. But part of the time there was mobile phone coverage. And of course, landlines have been operational, so people were using those as well.
So we will be putting up a link to the document you mentioned on the wiki where listeners can look it up later if they're interested. Getting to my last question, I would like to ask you, whether within your studies at the Diplomatic Academy, but also just, well, your research on a topic, is there any book or any specific blog or, you know, other reading source you've come across that you would like to suggest to people as, you know, as being worth their time reading?
Right. First of all, I have been following a bunch of blogs. I'm just the reason I'm speaking slowly is because I'm trying to look them up, and my bookmark collection is a complete mess. But there we go. One blog that is absolutely fabulous is it's a guy called Professor Chuan Cole, and his blog is called Informed Comment. The man is actually an expert on Middle East and American politics, and he has a very great combination of summarizing up-to-date events as they happen, but then also giving some commentary to explain what's going on. And I think that's a very, very important thing that you don't get by just following the Twitter stream. Obviously, the Middle East channel on Foreign Policy Journal is very, very good. So I can certainly recommend that. And another very nice blog is actually Arabist.net. And that's a blogger who just went to Cairo recently to cover what's going on there. And he's also putting up a lot of videos and images and gives some background that you wouldn't get otherwise. So that's probably the main sources I would recommend. And of course, my Twitter stream, because whenever I find something interesting, I'm trying to pass it on.
Right. Excellent. We'll put up these links as well on the wiki. Kyra, it's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. And I'm really thankful we get you found the time to be talking tonight. I hope we hear a lot of you within the next weeks, and hopefully not on this topic any much longer. And yeah, basically, thanks so much for being with us.
It's been a great pleasure. And if I may, I'd like to end with the words that a Syrian friend of mine spoke about this situation. And she said, three moments everyone must experience in a lifetime. Sunrise after a week of rain, the birth of a child, and witnessing the downfall of a tyrant.
Excellent words. Thank you so very much, Kyra. We'll be playing a little bit of music, and we'll be right back afterwards. Bye-bye, Kyra.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
Rock and roll music is the main weapon.
Of a riot, a storm, lightning, a function, a form, far from the normal, follow like cattle, I'm more like the catalyst, crawling the victor battle, who let the cowboy on the saddle, you don't know a missile from a gavel, paratera trooper, flipping loops to death, want innocent flesh, but I'm back in the sight of my foes and friends, with the force and the pen, against the line, I won't throw a defense, then a curse of murderous men, in suits of professionals who act like animals, man-child, ruthless and wild, who would speech back on the beach to Texas, Fiora, for sure, compassionless, con, server, lethal, needle to the floor, the jaw for crime is murder. Well, I was born, voice of a riot, a storm, lightning, the function, the form, far from the normal, follow like cattle, I'm more like the catalyst, calm in the mix of battle, who let the cowboy on the saddle, he don't know a missile. for the beans off our knees. Reach down with feet, their disease. Interlock your hands across these. A flag is a rag, it's a shroud out loud. Outside a faceless crowd. A cavalry trial just took a last breath. What's there in the march of death?
Welcoming you to the second part of tonight's show. With us now is Morgan Markiwar, aka Headhunter. He is Room IOI's official senior internet downtime correspondent. At least that's his job title for today, and I hear he likes it. That's probably just the way he rolls. Hi, Morgan.
Good evening. It's nice to be here. Thank you for such a wonderful introduction.
Oh, you're most welcome. Also, the tune we just played, the song by Zach De La Rocha and DJ Shadow called March of the Death, which is actually a wish by Morgan. Is there something you want to say about
that? Right. Yeah, I thought it was kind of appropriate just because it was a protest song that was released the day the Iraq War broke out many years ago. And so as a general commentary about... I guess, unrest in the Middle East. I thought it was a bit fitting.
It sounds fitting. Also, it sounded really good, and it's CC, and we're going to put up a download link if you like the song on the wiki, as we always do. So, as I said previously, this part is going to be a little more technical. We're going to look into the issue of if you rule a country and you do not want to get in it, you do not want information to get out, what would you do if you're not deciding to, you know, put up filters that filter out specific services, ports, websites, whatever, as we've seen before? So Morgan, could you elaborate like a minute on what the difference is to any approach that we've seen previously?
So I guess what's happened in Egypt recently is somewhat unprecedented in internet history. I mean, previously we've seen situations, I guess, in Tunisia or Iran where they've either dropped specific routes or they've filtered access to specific sites, usually, you know, Twitter, Google, or Facebook as such. However, in this case, Egypt removed itself entirely as a country from the internet, which is quite a drastic maneuver, basically meaning obviously every Egyptian provider covering every Egyptian bank, internet cafe, embassy, government office, whatever, was cut off from the rest of the world.
Right, but if we look a little bit at the dates and at the times, we see the starting point of specific visible prefixes at the time not being announced anymore is somewhat around 10 p.m. UTC. I think the first routes dropped at 22:12 on January the 27th. However, some prefixes were still announced. So this is a process going from January 27th to January 28th, where, like, I think Egypt announces, like,
around 3,000 prefixes, and they dropped to almost zero.
So what happened was is that around midnight local time on the 27th, Egypt started dropping routes, and they more or less dropped about 88% of them. Out of the top 10 Egyptian network providers, the only one that actually really appeared to be unaffected was Nord Data Networks. So you're right. Yeah, there's approximately 3,500 individual BGP routes withdrawn, which left practically no valid paths by which the rest of the world could exchange internet traffic with Egypt's providers. So that was about 50 different AS numbers that died.
Yeah, I think they have 51 ASs in total.
Right.
These announced routes, or not anymore announced routes, that were dropped, or prefixes. I think the first telcos that started were all within like 15 minutes dropping these routes. So this somehow looks very organized.
Yeah. So, I mean, Vodafone is one of the largest providers in Egypt. And they publicly acknowledged that they complied with the government order to suspend mobile services. So this is actually a legal action in Egypt, in that under Egyptian legislation, the authorities actually have the right to issue such an order, and businesses are forced to comply with it. From what we can ascertain, it seems highly likely that an order was issued to stop providing mobile and data services at a certain time. And then we saw the subsequent route broadcasts to the rest of the world fail or just stop over that period. Nor Data Networks, of course, stayed up.
Is that now because Nor did not receive such...
That seems highly likely. As opposed to believing that Nor stayed up due to any sense of freedom of internet or freedom of internet speech, it seems likely that this provider was allowed to remain broadcasting its routes because it's has links to foreign investment. As a few commenters noted, the Egyptian Stock Exchange, for instance, was founded in Nor address and was available until the 31st. So the networks for Nor data actually did disappear at some time.
Yeah, I think it was the night from 30th to 31st of January.
So it was on the 31st that they actually dropped off as well, which I think is probably, I mean, okay, so postulating this is perhaps entirely a personal reason, so I can't actually comment as to the reason. However, I do know that a lot of people were attempting to get people that had personal connections through Nor data networks to use open wireless access points so that people proximate to them could actually still have internet access.
You mentioned that the Egyptian Stock Exchange is on Nor data networks.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're also kind of specialized, as to what I read, on the banking and financial sector as well as the aviation
yes.
sector.
I
think the National Technology Group is on there. Also the American University in Cairo.
Yeah, so, I mean, there was actually a heavy link, not just to financials, but, again, to foreign investment, which I think is most pertinent, in that if one was to politically theorize, then one might suggest that foreign investment and foreign investment money and, indeed, the opinions of foreign investors are still obviously very applicable to the government's actions in the situation.
Of course, of course. So we're basically talking about dropping these routes or these prefixes,
mm-hmm.
Announcements or withdrawals or whatever, updates, on the border routers of Egypt. Obviously, it's easiest. I mean, if you at home have a country and you want to go...
Which I do at home.
Oh, of course. you just... I mean, probably your home, Morgan, is a little bit smaller in size. There's just one cable you'd have to cut. But basically, there's a lot of sea cables that are obviously
right.
easier to first lay and then maintain than, you know, having fiber optic cables run through just any kind of pampa.
And they might not belong to you for a start, right? Like, for instance, the undersea cable which connects Nor data networks, for instance, is operated by Telecom Italia. So if where you're going is would you cut or damage these cables, then potentially you're causing an international incident as well, if you, because they're exceptionally expensive undersea fiber cables. So say you decided to dynamite Telecom Italia's cable, people might be kind of pissed off with you from Italy.
Very true. Also, well, the reason we can tell, or we could tell just like from the first look that they didn't cut the sea cables, is that you could still reach other networks that would be behind this, like Asian, South Asian networks, that you could also access over these fiber optic cables.
So it is possible that they cut some cables. However, if cables were cut, then they would be very likely to be Ethernet cables in ISPs. Or, and in fact, I doubt that any cutting would have happened. It probably would have been admins simply pulling them out of the backs of machines.
Unplugging, right. What you could also just do is unplug your router, right?
Sure. That would definitely work.
Problem I see in that, though, if we're talking BGP, if you just disconnected your router and then reconnected it back up, you would get announcements from all your peers, which would actually make your router die. If you stay offline for a while, you'll receive so many announcements as you get back up that your router will just, you know, be overwhelmed. So obviously this is not how you do it either, right?
Yeah. It's interesting what happened in Egypt, because of the fact that, I mean, if you compare what's happened in terms of their BGP routes just stopping broadcasting, like to for instance, a famous incident of BGP malfeasance a couple of years ago, which was when Pakistan started broadcasting erroneous routes regarding YouTube. In that case, they were attempting to redirect YouTube internally in Pakistan. However, they ended up broadcasting these routes outside of their country. So Egypt, however, did not broadcast null routes or anything like that, right? They actually just simply stopped. And right. I mean, I would hypothesize the reason why they did this as opposed to anything else is, I mean, for instance, they could have applied filtering. They could have attempted to do something via DNS. But unlike DNS entries, which are cached and take hours, sometimes days to propagate, by discontinuing routing announcements, like ISPs very, very quickly disconnected across from the internet. I mean, we saw large chunks of Egyptian network space drop off within minutes.
So yeah, you mentioned filtering. Of course, you could just filter out BGP announcements.
Well, that's actually what happened previously in Tunisia, right, where they actually blocked very specific routes.
Now, as you cut off your country from the rest of the internet, you still, as you know, a maintainer of a country or whatever, of a situation in the country, you might not want people inside the country to communicate anymore.
Right.
Which would, of course, be possible. I mean, Egypt has an internet exchange, but it's also very likely that ISPs under each other have other crossings across the country. If you look at the US, for instance, it's such a huge country, it would be probably impossible to take down every ISP routing inside the country within minutes or with that much ease, I think.
I can't comment with any degree of certainty on the state of Egypt's internal network, since they dropped their routes, I haven't been able to trace route into Egypt. Well, since they brought it back up, sure. But during the period of the outage, it would just be theorizing. However, I mean, one thing that we do know for sure is that ISPs in Egypt do use services from external to Egypt, DNS for one. So even if there was connectivity internally in Egypt, which I don't doubt that there was between certain areas, I very much doubt that there would have been anything resembling, you know, working Egyptian internet, if you see what I mean.
Of course. You would also talk about border routers to other ISPs, and it would be just as easy, because it's working BGP, you could just as easily drop these announcements and route.
Right.
Now, internally, within like one ISP, and we mentioned it before, but I'm saying it again, Egypt has very, very little ISPs inside the country, a very small number. So internally, these ISPs are likely to use something like eBGP or even OSPF, ISIS. Probably we should, for those of our listeners that are not so much into networking, mention what the whole difference is between BGP and, say, OSPF.
Right. So, I mean, really, really briefly, BGP is about exchanging routes between, say, external peers. So it learns routes from your internal network and announces them to other ASN owners. I mean, this is actually what makes it so effective for disconnecting a country's internet, as opposed to the other methods that we discussed. Because if you're running BGP, or one of the people in charge of running BGP for Egypt, then you're responsible for your own routing announcements. It's very, very trust-based in this aspect. And so you would broadcast to people externally what the routes look like inside Egypt. So if you just stop talking to them, then they have no real idea how to route traffic to you. Routes stop being announced. They don't know where your IP ranges are. All traffic dies.
Right. The way how OSPF works is so very different, because it's so much more, let's say, fail-proof. If one router goes down and it doesn't announce anymore, it will be there's nothing, not one single packet going to be sent to it again unless it comes back up. And an OSPF is basically just short for open shortest path first. Shortest in that terms means not only just the length of cable, but of course how fast this connection would also be. So the second shortest path will be used. If there's so many connections, you could just go a number of ways, but you're picking the shortest that is available to you right now. And at every next hop, at every next router, there's going to be, you know, an internal discussion on the router, say.
Right, yes.
Which is the next path you're going to take? Which is the next cable you're going to just send the packet to?
Right. So, it's essentially algorithm-based, right? And it's mainly concerned about routing based on link state, speed, availability, and that sort of thing.
So basically, we could just say that BGP is some sort of address book a router has that he shares with the next ISP's border router.
Right, it's a reachability protocol, right? It says, you can reach my networks here. And then if you stop telling the guy where to reach them, then he doesn't
reachable. So yeah, how would you, if you had the task at an ISP's system administration board to stop routing any traffic within your network, let's say you're using OSPF, which approach would you take there?
I guess it really, really depends on, I'm not sure I would use OSPF to do that. I mean, there's a lot of places. Yeah, I'm going to say, I guess that really heavily depends on how people primarily connect to your network. You could just stop handing out DHCP leases. I mean, that'd be great, right? there's a lot of ways you can disconnect your users from your network. As I say, actually stopping, I would probably not change any of my routing tables at all. I would just stop handing out addresses to my users.
Right, you very frequently, or at least that's what I saw, see that within an ISP's network, you have like a star-based network. So you have some more core routers that have other routers attached. And if you just, you know...
But most ISPs don't know how this works, right? They have to do seances to figure out what happens in their core. So even if they get a court order, they really, really, really don't want to change anything on those core routers. So what they're going to do is they're going to change stuff on things that they know how to do and are really easy to fix and rebuild.
Probably so. Probably a lot of them use some administrative framework as well. Not, right, as far as I know, in Austria, although there's one provider who actually claims he's doing that. But as far as I know, he doesn't. But yeah, basically, you can just stop OSPF on core routers, and that will basically make your network go down as well.
Sure. But I mean, having said that, if I wanted to stop users connecting to my network, I would probably stop them from connecting at the edge rather than dropping them in the core. I mean, As I said, if I didn't want people on my network, then I would stop them as far out as possible, especially because it would probably remove the possibility of inquisitive jerks trying to poke around your network to figure out what you've done. Which I'm not saying that, you know, anyone I know would be into that sort of behavior, but
of course not.
You know, I don't know if there was heavy protests going down and I was a hacker in Egypt, then I would probably be reasonably tempted to actually take a look at the network if I was still allowed to connect to it and I found it just wasn't routing me out to the internet.
So there's one thing you mentioned earlier, which is DNS.
Mm-hmm.
I looked it up, and Egypt has three root name servers, basically, one of which is in Egypt, whereas the other two are actually based, one of them, so the secondary name servers are based in the States, and one is based in Austria, which I find kind of funny at that point. Probably just as a quick side note, what is the difference between, you know, your primary name server and your secondary name server?
For whom?
Well,
like, so,
for,
I mean,
for the maintainer of the name server. I mean, if you're receiving new information on, you know, this IP should go to this domain name, or basically,
so,
if you're looking,
I mean,
up this domain name, you'd have to go to,
I guess, IP. I guess, for instance, so, like, the... The root name server looks after the delegation for everything under, say, .eg, right?
Right.
In
this case, actually, also .masr. For those of our listeners who are not familiar with that TLD, that's the Arabic script top-level domain. So we didn't have any, or there was no resolution for not only just the TLD.eg, but also .masr. If you're looking at it from the outside, you could still reach those secondary name servers that I mentioned earlier. So a secondary name server gets a TTL, a time to live, for how long the information that it holds, if there is no further connection from its primary name server that he could pull updated information from, is being held, which in this case is 140 days.
Which, as I discussed before, right, is one of the reasons why, like, fiddling your DNS is not a particularly rapid way of ceasing access to your country's internet resources, or stopping people in your country, I guess more primarily in this case, from accessing external resources like Twitter, which is largely due to caching around the world. And that's, while there is convention amongst people who maintain root servers, there is not so much amongst people who maintain many of, as you described, the secondary servers or servers further down the DNS tree, in that any local DNS implementation maintainer can implement their own server and cache things for as long as they really want.
Right. Also, this is something that really works for Egypt. Just downtiming your root name server for a little bit is something that works out there, because they don't have, like, 13 organizations that all have their own name servers that are attached to this network, and that would still be reachable, right? If you just have three name servers, you know, you pretty much have in hand whether they're running or not.
So actually, the fact that that Egypt was one of the first countries with an Arabic top-level domain is kind of interesting, actually. Like, I think that, for instance, if they actually decided to, depending on how many people actually use their DNS servers, right, especially their root servers, it is likely that, for instance, had they decided to broadcast bogus, for a start, if they decide to broadcast bogus DNS information, then there might have been a considerable amount of collateral damage outside of Egypt. And additionally, as we saw with WikiLeaks, it's not that hard to get past, right, in that people very quickly remember that they used to FTP zone files around and start posting things all over the internet with IP addresses of sites corresponding to, you know. By the time that the first person noticed DNS was dying, then if you Googled, like, IP of Twitter or something like that, then, like, yeah. So you can kind of see where I'm going.
If you could still Google, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you could probably use Ask Jeeves or something, right? That's my secondary go-to search engine.
Of course. In your everyday life. We're actually running out of time, but I think we'll just overdo a little bit, and I hope that GMC, who's in charge of Signal, won't be too mad at me. But there's a couple more interesting questions that I wanted to
put. Okay.
Just recently, there was some discussion, and probably this is also very prominent in Austria, since there was some misinformation from our government regarding whether they would make use of a law that's already established, but quite, you know, doubtfully going to happen, but anyways, of deploying something called a kill switch. I've seen especially a lot of Americans raging about this issue that, you know, now all of a sudden this talk about this kill switch that actually has been there before. I think Lieberman imposed this idea just, you know, a year back or something. What would you say about an internet kill switch, Morgan?
I mean, naturally, I'm wildly opposed to any such ideas, right? And that, I mean, we're if you believe that people do have basic rights to freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and so forth, then it is very obvious to, I think, most people these days that the internet provides this, and therefore, by removing the ability of people to assemble and voice their opinions in a meaningful way, then you are effectively depriving them of these rights. Now, you could get into a semantic argument about this, but that's basically, I think, reasonably obvious to most internet users. So philosophically, I'm not very into such an idea. I think it sets a reasonably bad precedent doing these sorts of things. But having said that, talk of a kill switch is in some way largely hype, right? In that governments have always had control of the internet within their own country. In that if you're a carrier or an ISP and you receive either a legal statement or a bunch of armed law enforcement officials kick down your door and decide to start smashing your stuff, there's not a lot you can do about it. And either of these is probably going to result to a lack of service. Having said that, people are pretty inventive, and so is the internet. So, I mean, what we saw in Egypt is despite the BGP routes going down, a lot of free dial-up was used by people to get out of Egypt wherever they actually still had service via telephone networks. And I saw providers from Spain, France, the Netherlands offering dial-out service to free accounts all over Europe. I mean, I guess if you really wanted to, you could attempt to tunnel IP over shortwave radio, which I have no idea how much that would suck. But I'm just saying, right? Like you could. There are a lot of ways that one could attempt to circumvent this type of state censorship.
And one does actually attempt to this. This is basically what we've seen, use of outdated technology, you could even call it. People starting again to use dial-up lines, use modems. There was, or there is, or probably now there was, a Tor project running, which I'm going to put up a link to on the wiki as well, where they would try to collect funds to buy satellite phones that you could use to tell them the internet out of the country.
That's actually a very good and practical idea. However, I have a better but a lot less practical idea, which myself and a colleague came up with. What you really need to do, right, is you need to run lasers. And you can do this via line of sight, right? So if you had a laser off the coast of Egypt going to, say, a submarine, maybe some type of data haven, you can see where I'm going with this, right? Like, see, this is a fantastic idea. People need to go laser technology and then, you know.
This is truly a senior and downtime correspondent's idea, obviously.
Right. So, I mean, joking aside, right, like you can actually do point-to-point link with lasers for like not insane amounts of cash these days. Now, I mean, obviously, this is not necessarily practical in a lot of situations, but it is a good example of how people can start getting inventive, right, if you start implementing these methods. I mean, unless you really wanted to go, right, like EMP pulse on your country or something, then I think people are always going to find a way to transfer the bits.
And to circumvent such kill switch deployments.
Information wants to be free!
So, there's one last question that I just got in, actually, from one of our future listeners, because this is going to be streamed in the future, which is your opinion on how, how feasible it would be to down, basically, the whole internet.
a bunch of people have talked about this, and there are methods that one could use if one wanted to down the whole engine. I mean, I guess people have talked extensively about like attacking the root name servers. Obviously, if you can get control of a bunch of core routers, then you could do a lot of damage as well. So it depends. For instance, I mean, what your end game is here, right? Like, is your end game to be a punk kid and cause a bit of a blackout, or do you want to down the internet for an extended period, right? Because then all of a sudden you start playing root wars on the internet, and that's a really interesting game to be playing, right? root wars with the internet, against the internet, because there'll be a lot of people trying to fix it. You could cause temporary outages to large portions of the internet, I think, without stretching your intellect too far for esoteric methods of attack. But for instance, if you say wanted to down the whole of the internet for a week, that would be a pretty interesting undertaking.
So for a very last question, one that I also asked Kyra, I hope I'm not surprising you too much with this. Is there a specific book or, you know, some sort of reading resource that you would...
Yes, if I'm going to say one thing, I'd probably leave people with the message that it's probably a good idea to actually spend their time learning a little bit about the politics of other countries, not just when they're under active revolution, but if people actually took the time to do so anyway, then they'd probably find it quite rewarding. Given that I know a lot of people who've become armchair experts on Egypt over the last 2 weeks. So perhaps a plea for broader political education and understanding from most of our listeners.
So if you can think of anything later, we could, of course, put this up on the wiki as well. And now, as we already are way over time, I would like to thank you very much, Morgan, for spending your time with us and giving us a little bit more insight on the technical side of internet downtime and Egypt in that specific regard.
Internet downtime is one of my greatest fears.
Will we hear you again on this show as a senior expert consultant?
It would be a delight.
Awesome. Thank you so very much. Thanks everyone for listening in, and have a good night.
Thanks. Until next time.